Game on, weeknights from 6 on 2FM.
Thanks to the two Johnnies, it's Tuesday the 18th of April and this is Game On. Coming up today, we'll assess Chelsea's Champions League chances against Real Madrid. Madrid even, with Keith Tracy and Mark Langdon.
Plus Shane Stokes will profile cyclist Ben Healy's rapid rise and Daniel Whiffen will join us to reflect on his latest records. If you want to get in touch, please text us on 51552 or tweet at GameOn2FM.
Game On on 2FM.
Welcome along, how are you, Ruby?
I'm great, Marie. I'm assuming you're all happy, seeing as Liverpool managed to win 6-1 last night. What's going on? Why are they scoring all the goals in individual games? 6-1, 9-0, 7-0. What's wrong with just 1-0 every week?
I hate to say it, but it feels like they kind of turn it on, really, when it doesn't matter as much. Like, there wasn't as much expectation or pressure on them in that game, and they seem to play with a little bit more freedom, maybe?
Maybe. Perhaps.
We need to get a sports psychologist in to talk to us about that. Keith Tracy, Arsenal fan. He might actually... Keith Tracy's going to come in now. He was sitting outside there and he's going to come in and give us his views on why Liverpool are able to do it against the... Well, I suppose they did do it against United as well, but against Leeds. Keith, you've played at that level. How would you assess what Liverpool did last night against Leeds? Where did it come from?
I think it's I don't want to call it a once-off, but Liverpool away from home this season have been absolutely woeful. Some of the away performances, I think before they got that win last night, they had a similar away record to Southampton. Southampton are obviously looking relegation down the barrel, so it just goes to show you how poor Liverpool have been away from home. But Ruby's right, they do click every now and then, and when they do, they're still the old Liverpool, but once they come away from Anfield, they just look so, so flaky at the back. It's ridiculous. But big improvements last night, but to say I think they're going to make the top four, the top six, I'm not too sure.
Why would they be?
No Champions League, Marie. All right,
I'm trying to ignore you now. Just like I'll mute you now in a second. Still a lot of football to be played, Ruby. Why? What is it though about a home ground? So, when you're playing at that level in the Premier League and you can have this record at home, is it the fans? Like we obviously. We've seen what what an effect they can have on the team, or like some teams don't have fans like that and are able to play better at home.
Yeah, it's mostly just the way the game is played. The fans, when you go to Anfield, you know the cop is going to demand that they're in full voice, and most of the time the Liverpool players don't have much of a choice but to give them a performance because it really is that demand. And I've gone into Anfield on the Hillsborough disaster, and the fans they're just always up for it there. And like you say, when Liverpool are at Anfield against the bigger clubs, they sort of look after themselves. It's the other ones that are just really struggling to get over the line. Look, I think Klopp has addressed it a couple of times already. He needs a couple of more signings next season. We'll probably be a truer reflection of them, but the rock and roll football is just, I think, caught up with them over the last couple of years.
I like that, rock and roll football.
So what's it been this year? It hasn't been rock and roll, it's been more what?
Wet fish, I think. It's been awful, hasn't it? But again, Ruby, it's been away from home.
We'll come back to the rock and roll football in a little while, but we're going to stay with rock and roll because Daniel Whiffen joins us on the line. We had Daniel on a while back and he was breaking records for fun. He has continued to break records for fun over the weekend. He knocked 3 Irish records down, which is a rare thing, and it's rare to even see it been done in a variety of events. Daniel, how are you?
Good, how are you?
Good to be chatting to you again so soon.
Yeah, it's great. Nice to be back.
You always know that when someone is on like a few weeks after they've just been on, they keep doing special things. And once again, Daniel, you've done that this weekend. 3 Irish records and in a range of events. How are you doing it?
Just trying hard, I guess. I don't know.
Easy.
It's a little bit more than trying hard now, in fairness. Like, I mean, get in there for 400 metres, 800 metres, 1500 metres, break every Irish record there is, break your own records. If it was as easy as trying hard, we'd probably all be doing it. So you may give us a little bit more than trying hard, Daniel.
Daniel, you're on now with Ruby Walsh, who is the king of getting the best out of himself. So he's not going to take it easy from you.
Yeah, I guess. Well, we're just obviously changing different stuff up in training and like working in different areas of the sport, especially the psychologist end. I mean, stepping up our mental game just to make sure we're hitting every race as best as possible. And I just gonna say it again, just training harder than ever.
So you say stepping up your mental game, what's that, concentration or belief, bit of both?
Yeah, confidence and I guess just keeping my head screwed on during the race. 1500 is quite long, so it's like just under 15 minutes. So just trying to make sure I'm basically staying confident throughout the race and trying to beat my competitors.
Does that mean staying confident? Does that also mean tactically? So are you, have you got targets for yourself at every 50 or is it every 100?
So we'd split the 1500 up into three 500s. So it'd just be like sticking to the plan. Normally we're getting quicker each 500 to make sure we're finishing fast. And yeah, I guess everybody's kind of different race plan, but mine worked out this weekend, so it's good.
It's such a long time to be focused and trying to hit those markers as you go along. Do you think about, what do you think about, or what comes into your mind, or do you have a process that you carry out mentally?
So I guess most people like to say to sing a song in those 15 minutes, but I normally am thinking about, I'm looking around me sometimes to see where everybody else is in the race. And then I'm also thinking about when I need to make my move, say in the 1500. Normally people make it between 800 to 1000 meters in. So you've got to be like conserving energy or stuff like that, and making sure you're hitting your turns right on the wall. That's, yeah.
Is every distance strategically different then for you?
Yeah, so the 400 is like a sprint, I guess, for me. I mean, I guess it's kind of weird calling 400 meters a sprint, but yeah, that's more like basically I'm just going all out for the whole, like it's like 3.5 minutes. And then 800's in a nice in-between race. It's a bit between a sprint and like a mid-distance, I guess. And then 1500's just you need to settle into a pace quick and just see how long you can hold it for.
You're getting a huge amount of plaudits for that 1500 metres. So you knocked 15 seconds off your own record that you had. People are just saying how impressive it was, Daniel. For you, was that, like, how big a deal was it for you to achieve that?
Yeah, well, I mean, I went from maybe 40th in that event ever to 4th, I think, ever now. So it's pretty amazing. And I, yeah, as you said, I knocked off a lot of time. I was kind of expecting, I think, to knock off quite a bit of time, but I mean, that was quite a lot. I skipped the whole 1440s. I think somebody said on Twitter, I saw that that was my third ever swim under 15 minutes, and it was only 2 and a bit seconds off the world record. So it was pretty cool to do. And I also did it in like quite a stacked field, I guess, because number like 6 full time was in the race as well. So it was kind of cool.
And what about the reaction to it, Daniel? Because it seems like it's been huge. How have you handled it?
Yeah, well, my reaction after the race was quite funny. I think I had my head like in my hands, like I was pretty shocked. I was in the water. And then after I got out, I was obviously really happy with it. I was kind of speechless in my interview, I think, after my race. But I've settled into it now and I'm ready to go back to training and have another crack at a world record in the summer.
How about a crack at an Olympic medal?
Yeah, I guess that's our long-term goal in a year and a half. And I think, to be honest, it's getting very real.
What is the plan? So you're out cracking a world record. If you get to a world record, so you're training, you're still in Loughborough, right?
Yeah, I am. I've just got back from Stockholm yesterday, and I guess I'm taking today off, and I'll probably go back tomorrow training and continue building. We got world champs in Japan this summer, where hopefully that's where I'm going to target that world record and that gold medal, and then that'll be a great building for the Olympic season to try defend my world title if I get it at Olympics.
Oh, I like the sound of that. That you're already picturing it. You've achieved so much over the last little while. Is it possible for a swimmer, Daniel, to keep hitting the levels that you're at for the next year and a half till you get to that goal?
Well, I can't. I don't know anybody who's done it in my event. But I mean, I don't see why not. I'm going to try, and if I hopefully do well this summer, I'm definitely going to take that confidence into the next season and try get one of Ireland's ever first, if not the first, Olympic medal.
That would be something quite extraordinary. Wouldn't be the first Olympic medal, mind. There were a few. with a different summer. Yeah. But so your plan back, you're back in university this summer, World Championships. I know the World Championships had a short term goal, and that's as far ahead as you could look can look. But surely at 1500 metres, it's such a demanding event. There has to going to have to be a break period before you build to 2024.
Yeah, so we've got how many months? 4 until the World Championships, and then I've got actually a really good opportunity to race at home in the European Under 23s in Dublin. So that'll be a great event, and then I'm going to probably take a week or two off after that to like reset, and then we'll be training flat out until the Olympics then. And yeah, I guess it's going to be a great season.
Do you not feel sorry for all your under 23s here in Ireland that you're coming back to swim with them, no?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's going to be a great event. I can't wait for that event, especially because it's so good. I think the last championship we had there was in 2002 or 2003, I think. So I'm really looking forward to that. And yeah, it's going to be a very exciting summer.
Daniel, what do you do with all of your ability? So you can excel in different distances and events. Is there one that you focus on? Do you do a few? What's the plan?
So I'd say my best is the 1500 right now. I mean, the 800 is still pretty good for me. I think I broke the European record there in December, so I'm still focusing on those two. The 400 is just a bit of fun, I guess. It's just
a warm up.
Yeah, a warm up. It's always first on the racing calendar, so you basically can call it a warm up. But
it'll blow out there. Get the lungs going there early in the day. We'll swim 400.
Yeah. Ruby is actually acting out swimming here, by the way. I know it's a radio, but it's quite entertaining.
But the training is slightly different for them each event. So you are 400. You're gonna have to do more like speed work where 1500 you're gonna have to do more like aerobic capacity work, so maybe that's why my 400 is still pretty decent this season. I think I'm third in the world at the moment, but I think towards the world champs we'll be more focused on that 1500 and 800.
So you're doing so well now, Daniel, but Nathan, your brother, is doing quite well too. Are you inspiring him to better times?
Oh yeah, definitely. I mean, he keeps progressing, and now he's moved up to my squad because we weren't actually training together in Loughborough. He was training in the squad below, but now he's moved up, so he's probably the only person who can get under my skin. And to be honest, I'm looking forward to it, and we're going to have some great battles and training, and probably a couple words passed between each other who my coach won't like, but it'd be funny.
Will you be battling for Olympic spots then?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, we've always said that we would love to go to the Olympics together, and I mean, Paris is only a the qualifier is only a year away, so it's going to be, I hope he can do it, and to be honest, he'd benefit the whole team going, so especially me. And I think it'd be great.
We've had Olympic success with brothers in rowing. I know that's a team event. It'd be something else if we had a couple of swimmers, Marie, wouldn't it?
Yeah, it would, absolutely. Yeah. And it would do great as well for the YouTube channel and the podcast and everything, I'd say too, Daniel.
Yeah, definitely. The YouTube videos probably will be a lot better with the both of us together. I know we're better as a pair.
And just in terms of profile, Daniel, because it does feel like your profile's really risen in the last few weeks, months. How are you finding all that added attention?
Yeah, I mean, I don't really mind the attention. I like the way more people are watching my YouTube videos because I'm only doing them for fun. So, and a lot more people keep coming up to me, especially I was back in Dublin there 2 weeks ago at the Irish Open, and I had loads of little children come up to me saying, oh, I love your videos, and I think that's why I keep doing them. But yeah, the attention's great, and hopefully there's more to come.
And what about the acting? Has it taken a bit of a backseat now?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, people still throwing out those fun facts of me being on Game of Thrones at competitions. But
I just did it about Daniel. I was on with the two Johnnies doing a promo, and I did exactly that.
Yeah, I think it's taking a back seat, but you never know what can happen in the future, I guess.
Exactly, you're still so young. Daniel Whiffen, thank you so much, and continued success. No doubt we'll be talking to you again very, very soon, but enjoy the 2 days off, I think you said you're having.
One day.
You're doing interviews on your day off. Do enjoy it though, and we'll talk to you soon.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Game on 2FM.
Welcome back to Game On. Marie, I was listening to the ads there during the break. I believe you're bringing the roadcaster to Punchestown again. Another road trip for you.
I love the road trips. I'll go anywhere. Sign me up.
Sign you up.
I great Punchestown it is. One. Two Johnnies. Yeah. So sound, those guys. You maybe gave me 3 minutes, did you? It's hard to track you down when you're in your natural environment, in your habitat there, you know. Everybody wants a piece of you.
Just floating.
You just wave as if, like, please don't go over and talk to me now and embarrass me in front of my real friends.
I beg your pardon, I did not. You didn't actually,
that is
even
exactly
when you were finished.
What happened to me.
And even when you were finished in your fancy roadcaster truck, you never came to say hello. You just out into the car park and went home.
I upgraded it. I got Jane Mangan to be my pal down there.
Got a real professional.
I absolutely did. But it is great though. Like, there's been brilliant racing over the last while. So, you know me, any big event, I'm on
you're
it.
There.
Don't ask me what's happening in between the big events. I'm just.
Yeah, see, you're going up in the world now. You're going up in the world now. I was only talking to Andrew, our producer, earlier. We're so lucky to still have you on Game On. Now you're all over Sunday Sport.
I'm trying to get out of here, but they just won't let me. Anyway, we are going to turn our attention to cycling now. Ben Healy has become a familiar name of late, and over the last couple of days, he continued his superb run of early season form when he finished second at the prestigious Amstel Gold Race in the Netherlands. And I'm delighted to say that Shane Stokes, cycling journalist, joins us now to tell us all about Ben, his history and his potential. How are you, Shane?
Good, thank you. How's things?
Good. You're like, at this stage, every time we're bringing you on, you're giving us details on all the different cyclists. You're our go-to. You'll be a historian in years to come, Shane.
I think it's a good complaint or good thing to be able to complain about, in that the Irish guys and women are doing really well. Megan Armitage, for example, performed really well at the weekend. Also, she was fourth in a very prestigious race in France. So, and she's actually... her team has told her that she will be selected for this year's Women's Tour de France, which will
Fantastic.
Be the first ever Irish
oh,
participation.
Brilliant.
So, yeah,
great.
There's good news all around.
Pencil
which is,
in
which
for
is
that.
Great.
We'll be on to you.
Marie's bringing the roadcaster to the Tour de France with her.
Yeah, that's
Shane,
an idea.
See, I'm telling you. Shane, if we start at the beginning with Ben, he's born in Kingswinford in England, which is east of Birmingham, south of Wolves, near Dudley. His qualification for Ireland, what's his connection with Ireland?
His father's family, his father's parents, his father's brothers grew up in Ireland and moved to England, and then Ben's father was born in England, but he has that familial connection, and then he declared for Ireland after 2016 and has been racing for Ireland ever since. I spoke to him yesterday actually, and he said that it was very much a case of realising there was better opportunities with Ireland, but that sense of identity has really built up since then. You know, more and more that he feels more and more Irish. And I asked him where his, I suppose his toughness comes from, and he says it's probably the Irish genes, like looking at Kelly and Roach and what they did. So yeah, I think he feels fully Irish now.
And that's what he did at the weekend. I mean, Stephen Roach was second in the Amstel Gold Race. Sean Kelly was third in it. So he's starting to do the things that those role models did before him.
Yeah, absolutely. So he was second, and he was second to Tadej Pogačar, who's won two Tours de France, who is the world's number one and who's absolutely dominant. He was in a break, Ben Healy was in a break with him, and with Tom Pidcock, who won the Alpe d'Huez stage of last year's Tour and is seen as the next big thing. He was actually, Pogačar attacked and got a gap on the other two, and then Ben Healy dropped Tom Pidcock and was actually coming back to Pogačar until the race director's car went in front and dragged out the gap a little bit through, you know, the aerodynamics of the car, which caused a bit of a furore that potentially Ben Healy might have got back up to Pogačar. So I suppose the takeaway is it was a stunning performance. He's only 22. And he's, you know, his second place in the Amstel Gold Race was the joint best result, you know, following on from Stephen Roach's second place in 1982. And last Wednesday, he was second in the Brabantse Peel Race, which equaled Sean Kelly's run-up slot in 1980. So it's really good company if you think about it. And he's only 22 years of age, and he's already doing these kind of performances.
Just go back to last Sunday. I know there was a bit of a furore around the aerodynamics that Pogačar used by getting in the slipstream of his team car. Is there any ramifications, stewards' inquiry, referee's whistle. Well, does anything happen?
It wasn't actually his team car. It was the race director's car, Leo Van Vliet, who said afterwards that he wanted Pogacar to win, you know, being the big name. I suppose it gives his race more prestige. So, I mean, that was a stunning admission, you know, to firstly drive, you know, just in front of the rider and absolutely influence the result. But secondly, to admit that he was the preferred winner, it just really didn't come across well.
What's the prize money in this?
That's a really good question, and I don't know off the top of my head, but it's probably, you know, the prize money in cycling isn't anything like you'd get in golf, so you're probably talking tens of thousands as opposed to more than that.
Tens of thousands is plenty of money if you're a cyclist. Yeah. Cycling on your I don't give a damn. Tens of thousands is plenty of money in horse racing.
Yeah.
So in other words,
now Ben Healy did say that he thinks, you know, he may have got back up to him, but that it would have been very hard to win in a sprint, that Pogacar would be a better sprinter than he, but he said it still would have been good to have been there, and I think to take that away from him, you know, wasn't very professional, not least by the race organiser himself. So hopefully things will be tightened up, because that shouldn't happen.
That'd put fire in his belly anyway, if nothing else.
It sounds like there should be repercussions to making a statement like that.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, you know, for the race director to say, you know, this is the guy I preferred to win, and, oh, by the way, my car was here, but didn't have any effect on the outcome, which is pretty staggering. So yeah, we'll see. I haven't heard of any repercussions as yet, but hopefully things will be tightened up. But as you say, yeah, as Ruby said, it will put fire in his belly. He's doing Flèche Wallonne tomorrow, which is a prestigious semi-classic, and then he's doing Liège-Bastogne-Liège on Sunday, which is like one of the five biggest one-day races in cycling. We'll be fired up for both of those.
Shane, did you expect him to go on this journey? Like, was his trajectory always to get here, or is it? Has he surprised you, basically?
He's surprised this year in that he has really made a pronounced jump up from last year. Now, he was always a very aggressive rider that went close to big wins, big professional wins. But he's definitely stepped up a level this year. But that said, he has said, he told me yesterday that he's lost 6 kilos, that he was heavy going into last season, and he worked really hard on that. And he definitely was talented. I mean, if you go back to 2019, there's a race called the Tour de l'Avenir, which is basically the under 23 Tour de France. And he won a stage there at 18 years of age, and was the youngest ever winner of a stage. So he's definitely had potential for years. And I suppose this season is where he's really stepped it up, and probably took a lot of people by surprise by just what an improvement he's made on last year. But he absolutely had that potential. Maybe people might have expected maybe perhaps another year before this happened. And that kind of trajectory is really encouraging for the future, because, you know, he took two wins in March as well, the first two wins of his pro career. He won a stage of the Settimana Internazionale Coppi Bartali, and he won the one-day race, the GP Industria and Argentinato, if you excuse my Italian pronunciation. So yeah, he's having a stunning season, and is hoping to keep that momentum going, obviously.
I doubt we're going to pick you up on your Italian pronunciations on this show just yet. Anyway, Andrew O'Connor, our producer, might, but myself and Marie most certainly aren't. But 6 kilos, that's 13.2 pounds. That's almost a stone. To shed that, to me, just means he's a hell of a lot fitter.
Yeah, definitely. And it's just, you don't have to carry that weight up hills, which is really important. He said that he turned pro last year, and he said he just sort of let himself go. I suppose getting the pro contract, he went, oh, I'm there now. And he didn't, you know, take as much care of himself as he should have last winter, the winter of 2021-22, and was much more focused on that this year. I suppose the other thing is that when a rider's had his first pro season, you have the benefit of those kilometres in your legs, and that will naturally bring you on as well. So, yeah, it's very encouraging. He's going to do in May the Giro d'Italia, which is his first 3-week tour, which will be a real barometer, I suppose, for what his future potential will be. That if he, you know, he wants to go for a stage win there, which is absolutely achievable. But in terms of the overall standings, you know, the first one or two Grand Tours will kind of give a barometer for what could be possible in the future.
Where would he be standing, or where would he be ranked within his team going to the Giro? Will he just be, I know, not an outrider, but where would he standing be within that team?
I think they probably, I haven't seen the lineup for the Giro, so they probably will have a designated leader. They may have somebody like Hugh Carthy. I'm not sure if Rigoberto Urán is doing it, but they will have a dedicated leader for that race. But I would imagine he will absolutely be one of the favourite guys for stage wins, because, you know, he's going very well and he has that aggression. He likes to be on the attack and to have a long, hard day where there's a real slog is where he tends to shine. So I think he'll absolutely be one of the protected guys in that sense.
Shane, we can't help ourselves when it comes to young athletes, hyping them up and putting expectations on them. How much potential does Ben Healy have, and what does his future look like?
I think on the basis of what he's done this year, and indeed, you know, referring back to that Tour de l'Avenir stage win as an 18-year-old, yeah, I think it's really, really encouraging. You remember that Dan Martin and Nicholas Roach retired a couple of years ago, so this is like the next wave. Now, Sam Bennett is still there. He's trying to get back to his top form. He obviously won two stages in the Tour de France in 21 and the Green Jersey, and is still trying to regain that kind of momentum. But he will absolutely coach the Tour this year, hoping for that. And then you've Eddie Dunbar, who's another guy slightly older than Ben, who's dedicated team leader for the first time this year, and he's also going to be in the Giro d'Italia and will be trying for a top 10 overall. But I think the basis, you know, given that Ben Healy has been second in the Amstel Gold Race and taking these other results this year as a 22-year-old, I think he absolutely has the potential to be winning classics and shorter stage races. And I suppose the big question is, how will he be over 3 weeks? Will he become a contender for races like the Giro d'Italia and the Tour de France? What's great is that he is a good time trialist. Sometimes guys are good climbers, but not necessarily good time trialists. But he is a very good time trialist as well. He's been Irish national champion, but also performed well in international time trials. And so he's very exciting. And I think the next few months will tell a lot about where he's going in the sport.
On the 17th of May, Ben Healy will be on stage 11 of the Giro d'Italia from Camaiore to Tortano. That's probably way wrong, but something like that. But the Ross will be starting in Navan when it's making its way to Burr. He
Not
probably won't
right,
be
Marie.
In it. What's that?
You got Navan and Burr right anyway.
Did I, Marie? I wasn't so sure about Burr. Navan was a certainty because there was a race course there, but Burr, no race course in Offaly. That was going to be a struggle. But the Ross does start then, five stages. And who'll be in that?
There will be, well, the defending champion is Dara Feely. He won last year and it was the most successful showing in decades for Irish riders. So he was the first Irish champion in 14 years. But then you had four of the five stages being won by Irish riders. So, you know, you'll have a lot of these guys who are racing domestically and then I suppose emerging internationally. It's very much, I suppose, a race for the future talents. Generally, the guys that ride it are younger, the kind of the international type guys that ride it are younger. So you're going to have Dara Feely will certainly be there, and there'll be, you know, other promising Irish riders there as well. And I got details today from the race organisers, so that there's going to be either 10 or 11 international teams, the first three of which will be announced tomorrow. There's 10 at the moment. There's one place available. At the moment, you have the Irish national team. You've got 10 international teams and then 23 Irish domestic teams. There's one slot available and it's been offered to an Irish domestic team. And if they don't take it, then another foreign team will be on board by tomorrow evening. So, yeah, you're talking about 10 or 11 international teams and a total of 175 riders. So, yeah, it should be really interesting. And it's a harder race than last year, a bit more hilly, a bit longer. So that'll be really good as well.
I was just looking at the stages, actually, in my own mind. I was thinking Navan to Burr, you're going south, sort of downhill. Burr to Ennis, same thing. Ennis to Castlebar, that has to be uphill because you're going back north. That sounds just so far, doesn't it?
Yeah, believe it or not, actually, day three is the...
I know it's the shortest one.
The sprinting stage, yeah. That the first stage has a category one climb just 20 kilometres from the finish. So that's usually the first day is not necessarily that decisive, but I suppose the idea this year is to try and set a pattern early on, and if a guy gets the yellow jersey early, that he'll be open. He'd be under attack for 4 days. So stage two is a hilly day. Stage three is a flatter day. Stage four goes to Charlestown to Monaghan and is going to be the longest of the race. So it's 175.9 kilometres. And it's got three category three climbs. And then the final stage to Blackrock, County Louth, is mainly flat and kind of will be... I suppose all about the yellow jersey trying to defend his lead to the finish. So, yeah, it's going to be very interesting. What's encouraging is that the organiser confirmed, or that the race director confirmed today, that they do have the sponsorship. They were chasing sponsorship, and they do have enough for this year to get this year's event over the line, if you like. But they're very much looking for. Sponsorship for next year and beyond to have the race on a better financial footing. So I think they're open to offers, and the idea is to try and get a title sponsor like they had before with the likes of FBD Insurance and On Post. So that will be the dream scenario, is that you've got one big company coming on board with a multi-year commitment. But I suppose the important thing is that it's happening again, and it's trying to build on last year, and should be a very good race.
Shane, it sounds great anyway, and hopefully it will get that title sponsor, because once it comes around, it definitely captures the imagination of everybody and the attention, because the beautiful scenery that we get to see as well. We'll be checking in with you soon, no doubt, and thanks for updating us on all of that, Shane.
Great, thank you so much.
Talk to you soon.
Game on 2FM.
We're going to turn our attention to rugby for just a minute. It's been a very difficult week. Another very difficult week, really, for the Irish women's rugby team. They lost 24-7 away to Italy in the Six Nations last Saturday, so that leaves them winless in three games. But around that game, there was a report in the Telegraph in England, and it details the reported failings of the IRFU around the women's rugby game, with head coach Greg McWilliams having to deny that the union was a sexist organisation. There's been a lot written about it, a lot of opinions, a lot of views. Some former players have come out and spoken about it. Social media has been awash with opinions as well. But Ireland's assistant coach Niamh Briggs was speaking to the media today, and she said that she feels there needs to be a greater focus on the future of women's rugby in Ireland rather than dredging up the past.
Yeah, look, it's hugely frustrating. We speak about that outside noise and the narrative that's around this group and around women's rugby in Ireland. It's incredibly frustrating for us. I think draining. I think we used as a management group over the weekend, but it's not a quick fix, and if we look for quick fixes, then the bottom will fall out. So week on week we've improved. I think each week we've got better at certain aspects, but yeah, lots of green shoots.
In effect, the group that are there now have to do their growing up in a goldfish bowl in front of live television, you know, online media, in front of the radio, in front of bigger crowds than ever before. With respect to when you were doing that growing up, that was all done and sort of the quiet fields of France in front of a couple of hundred people. Now it's been done in the full glare and spotlight of everything. So you must have respect, really, for the people who are doing that growing up to have to deal with this as well at the same time.
Yeah, hugely. Look, and I think it's funny, you know, 10 years ago we wanted, you know, more media and we wanted more exposure and we wanted people to see how good we were. And now we're on the flip of that. And what I want them to do is to be brave in how we play, brave in what we do. I don't want us to go back into our shell because people across the way are bigger and they're faster or they're 50 caps or they have 100 caps and we only have 2 and 3 caps, and all that goes out the window, and it's just 15 players be 15 players in terms of what we're trying to do. So if we allow that outside noise, we allow that pressure to impact and hinder us and how we want to play, then we're never going to get better.
That was Niamh Briggs speaking to Michael Corcoran. Ireland are playing England in the Six Nations on Saturday from 2:15. There'll be live commentary on Saturday Sport, and we'll be previewing that game as well later on in the week. Ruby, we're going to turn our attention to football, but I want to talk about Liverpool. But before we get to that, Keith Tracy is an Arsenal fan, and Keith, I haven't seen you since the weekend.
Oh, my nerves are jangling.
I would say so. So 2-2 draw at West Ham. Ultimately, given Manchester City another leg up, they get to climb another rung on the ladder towards the title.
Yeah, a lot of people are trying to persuade me to say that I thought Arsenal were going to win the league. I was never ever convinced.
You've
Arsenal.
Never said it. To be fair.
I have never said it. Yeah. I was staunch in my opinion. And look, I think Arsenal have been outstanding as a fan, as an Arsenal fan. I'm over the moon with how they're doing. I'm delighted we're in the middle of a title race. I didn't think we'd be in a title race. I thought we'd be lucky to be in a Champions League race. As it is, we've all but secured Champions League football, so I'm absolutely over the moon. My nerves are shot to pieces. Oh,
that's the line of a fella now who's preparing himself for defeat.
No, honestly, Ruby, at the start...
That's managing expectations now. That's what that line is.
That's an Arsenal fan for you. We're all terrified because as soon as I say I feel Arsenal are going to win the league, I knew they'd start the nosedive. I turned away from saying it, and I'm not saying they're nosediving, but City are just so, so good. They've all the form over the last couple of years. They've been in these dogfights with Liverpool, and they've just shown that they can get it done. Arsenal, when they went to, I think it was they played Spurs last season, and they're in a race for the Champions League football, they get beat in the North London Derby, and all of a sudden the season just capitulated. So that's still very fresh in my mind. We've come on leaps and bounds, and it's very, very hard to say I'd be disappointed if we finish second.
It's a funny one, like, so they miss a penalty on Saturday and all of a sudden it's a wobble, right? And I'm slagging you. But when I watched City at the weekend go 3-0, they were completely clinging on by the end of that game. I'm not as certain City are as rock solid as everybody else that seems to think they are, Keith.
No, I don't think they're rock solid defensively, Ruby. I think they can be got at, but just getting the ball off them in its own way is very, very difficult. And you know that if you give up anything, Haaland is going to hit the back of the net. Grealish all of a sudden is starting to be productive. I wasn't a big fan of Jack Grealish, I have to be honest. I thought he ran down the left wing, he turned back and he played the ball backwards, but all of a sudden he's become productive. He started hitting the back of the net, he's making assists left, right and centre, and it's just so, so hard to back against him. John Stones, like, they're letting Joe Cancelo go out on loan to Bayern Munich. It's mental stuff when you think of the squad, the players they have. It really is, it's a different world. I think Arsenal, this is obviously coming from an Arsenal fan, but I feel Arsenal have done it in the right way. We haven't gone out and thrown hundreds of millions at it. I know we have spent money here and there.
We're the heroes.
Well, it's better than throwing a load of cash at it, isn't it, and then, you know, going up the league. I think Arsenal have done it in the right way, like the likes of Saka, Martinelli, they're young lads that have come through the academy. So look, I think everybody would like Arsenal to see the win. All the neutrals would like to see Arsenal win the league because we don't want to see anybody dominate for that long.
Mark Langdon is with us in London. Mark, is Keith right to manage his expectations?
Well, I was just listening to Keith. As a Spurs fan, I'm maybe not neutral. I'm just one of those that is cheering on Manchester City. But Arsenal have had a fantastic season. I just wonder about the injuries. At the back, Saliba, take him out, and Rob Holding. You know, he's a steady Premier League player, but Saliba, one of the best in the league this season. Zinchenko plays that very difficult role. We've seen Alexander-Arnold trying it now, you know, where you start at left back, but you join in with midfield. And, you know, Kieran Tierney has got strengths, but that's not sort of his game either, really. And so Arsenal, you know, you mentioned there that Man City depth, they're able to let Cancelo go and, you know, rotate out Mahrez and Foden and Grealish and whoever else. And I that's maybe where Arsenal, if they do fall short, is where it will be. Just the squad depth. They've got some good players on the bench, but Manchester City just put up point totals that are just so difficult to chase down. And, you know, I'm not going to say Arsenal are bottom it because I don't think that they are. I think it's, you know, natural for teams to drop points, particularly away from home. And, you know, they're going to end up somewhere in the late 80s or maybe even 90 points, which would, you know, should be enough really to win league titles. But Liverpool have found that before chasing Manchester City that it's not always enough. And so it does look like it's City's to lose at the moment. But I still think it's closer than maybe some are suggesting. I don't think it's a foregone conclusion that City win that game next week. And, you know, people are already talking as if they've got those 3 points. You know, Arsenal have played well enough to say that they can cause City problems as well.
City are going to have to win it because they're going to spend $300 million increase in the capacity at the Etihad from 53,400 to 60,000. That's roughly £46,875 a seat, Mark.
Yeah, and the sort of in the cheap seats, they'll be joking that they can't even feel what they've got. So why do they need to add any more onto that? Of course, Manchester City have got their financial fair play issues at the moment that they're sort of battling against. But if they're to grow and continue to grow as a club, you need to bring in, you know, revenue streams, not only from sponsorship, which has been one of their main areas. And it's, you know, obviously very controversial the way that they've done that. You need to have a bigger stadium. you can charge more for your seats, you can get more exec boxes in, and you know, all that stuff that sort of the traditional football fan doesn't like. But it's very important in terms of you know, the bank balance sheets. And you know, City don't always sort of sell out the Etihad. It's not always a rocking atmosphere. So you would wonder about maybe some of them mundane Premier League games and whether they would fill it. But I don't think that matters too much, you know, to the owners of City. They've got the capital to be able to invest.
The one thing I'll say about all the kids coming up is that they're all wearing Man City jerseys. So there is a generation of Man City fans that are going to come of age in about a decade and probably will be going there all of the time. I'm going to turn my attention to Liverpool, if people don't mind. Ruby, any objections?
Yeah.
Well, you can hold him for a second, because I do want to talk about Alexander-Arnold and his role last night. It was interesting, Keith, and I've seen him being described today as filling a kind of a quarterback role, getting into the midfield, spraying passes. Do you think that's accurate?
It's very, very difficult. I think Trent Alexander-Arnold, he's not the best defender in the world. If you're going to play right back, it's one of the necessities. You have to be able to defend. It's a basic of the game if you're playing in that position. If he's going to play that inverted right back role where he ends up in midfield, like the job John Stones is doing for Manchester City now, yeah, Trent can do that. He's a very, very capable player. He can do that. For me, his big, big weapon is delivering from wide. When he's whipping balls in from wide areas and in those half spaces, it's very, very difficult. Can he play where he's back to goal like centre midfielders have to at times? I'm not too sure. He can be cutting the ball, but when Trent is coming onto the ball and he sees the ball, he can deliver it into the box. There's nobody better in that offensive right-back role, but defensively, huge, huge question marks about him still. But look, he's a very, very capable footballer. Could he play in the midfield for Liverpool? I'm not too sure. Like I say, I think he's better coming in from the wing, or staying out in the wing and whipping balls in from there. But in terms of defensively, if you're playing against Trent, you know exactly what you have to do. You have to pin him back and get him running towards his own goal. Easier said than done, I know, but there's a big, big question mark over his defensive capabilities.
Yeah, at this stage, no, I'd say you just want to give it up. Just too many mistakes, although Kanate didn't cover himself in glory last night either. Mark, just before we move on from Liverpool, do you think they're going to get top four football?
No, I don't. I think it's too far back for them. And then, of course, it's that sort of debate, isn't it? Are you better off sort of being in or out of the Europa League? Or I'm sure if they got sort of Europa Conference, it would be, you know, a very weak team that was selected. But just going back to Trent, I do wonder whether they're just looking, because obviously it's much cheaper to buy a good right back than what it would be sort of an equivalent central midfielder. So if they can turn him into a central midfielder, they would save, you know, a lot of money, which is clearly an issue for Liverpool at the moment, as Klopp has been mentioning.
It makes sense, because it looks like they're being priced out of the Jude Bellingham transfer as well.
Have you all spoken about Liverpool enough? I mean, move on. Something, Ben, something really matters in the world of soccer, like maybe Barcelona having a row with Madrid over paying referees. How about that, Mark?
Well, this has been a story that's been developing over the past month or so, really. So to go back to the beginning of it, Barcelona have been found to be paying like a consultancy fee to a former referee who was previously sort of looking after La Liga officials. And the Barcelona say that, you know, it was just to get reports on referees. It was nothing dodgy about this. It was sort of a near two-decade sort of thing, from early 2000 to a couple of years ago, and that, you know, there's nothing to see. Other clubs in Spain have said, well, you know, if you just take that literally, you've been paying people that are involved with referees. I mean, this is, you know, an absolute scandal. There's even suggestions that maybe UEFA would kick Barcelona out of future European competitions. They're sort of fighting at the moment for their integrity. And then their president, Laporta, went on the attack yesterday, where he basically said, well, Real Madrid have been getting refereeing decisions, you know, since forever. And, you know, they're the club of Franco, and, you know, they've always been the powerhouses in Spain. This completely infuriated Real Madrid, who then through their official Twitter put out a video on their website where they then sort of pointed to the fact that Barcelona won sort of more titles when Franco was running Spain, and that three times he managed to sort of save them from you know, from running out of money, and that if anybody was sort of the club of Franco, maybe it was them. Now, you know, this is has just gone down, like, as you can imagine, in Catalonia, absolutely terribly. You know, there's definitely a different side to the story that Real Madrid put out on Franco and what he did to the people of Catalonia. So it's really unsavoury. And if anybody sort of gets the chance to read Fear and Loathing, the book by Sid Lowe on sort of the rivalry between Real Madrid and Barcelona, you'll see that, you know, this really has something to do with football, but more often than not, it's not to do with football. And this is completely gone over the head now of sort of a rouse over referees, and has gone into something much more serious.
Keith, I think we can take it then that all the Barcelona fans are going to be shouting for Chelsea tonight, but Frank Lampard, he's really struggling. They've lost all three games since he took over. They're 2-0 down. What does he have to do at Stamford Bridge tonight to try and save Chelsea's career and maybe even his own job at this early stage?
Yeah, I think the first thing he needs to do, Ruby, is obviously keep a clean sheet. Are Chelsea capable of doing that? I really don't think so. You look at the team, the Trevor Chalobah, Thiago Silva, Wesley Fofana, the three centre-halves that are going to start for Chelsea tonight. I think Benzema's going to have an absolute field day. You know, he can be so anonymous for 80, 85 minutes and he will just hit the back of the net. It's what he does. He scored over 20, I think he scored 20 Champions League goals against English clubs. So he's a very, very dangerous player. And look, Chelsea throughout the season, their XG, their expected goals return, is actually not that bad. They're making chances. It's just they're not ruthless enough when they get in front of the goal. So are they going to get enough chances to hit the back of the net and overturn the 2-goal deficit? I really don't think so. Are Real Madrid not going to hit the back of the net? I really don't think so. I think Madrid will hit the back of the net, and Chelsea, you know, they'd be lucky to hit the back of the net maybe once or twice. But like I said, Chelsea might win the game, but they won't be going through.
Mark, reading the stats from your own Racing Post this morning or this afternoon even, Real Madrid have scored at least twice on their last four European outings in Britain. Can Chelsea score three? No, not three. That's four. That's five.
Yeah, I don't think so. I mean, as Keith was just saying there, you know, missing chance after chance. And, you know, they're probably, you know, even in that first leg, they did create a few moments at 0-0. You know, in the first couple of minutes, they had a great opportunity and they didn't take it. And they just haven't taken enough of their chances. And you just don't see how they can. I mean, the only reason they can, I suppose, is that, you know, football does strange things. Champions League, we've seen these remarkable comebacks that you just don't think can happen. But if you just look at it logically, you see the space that Chelsea will leave for Benzema and Vinicius to exploit on the counter-attack. And, you know, Liverpool fans at their cost, and that was, you know, one of those stats when they scored five at Anfield. You know, they're so devastating on the break. They've scored goals at Stamford Bridge before, and it should be a comfortable night for Real Madrid, who are not the type of team that usually gets flustered, you know, even if they do fall behind. Whereas, you know, we've seen when, say, Liverpool put that pressure on Barcelona and really turned it around. You just don't see Real Madrid do that very often in terms of panicking. So I think all logic says that Real Madrid will come through the tie.
And Mark, any suggestions on who will be the actual manager for Chelsea?
I think it probably is between Nagelsmann and Luis Enrique that they are the two standout men. I would say probably at the moment, maybe Luis Enrique is the slightest of favourites. I did mention a few weeks ago that he was sort of pushing for a job in the Premier League. We know he's been interviewed for that post at Stamford Bridge. He's managed Barcelona before, so he has got that sort of experience, I suppose, at a big club. And Nagelsmann's done that by Munich, but the fact that it ended badly for him at Bayern, it does make you wonder as to whether Chelsea would have doubts, because the question marks over Nagelsmann in terms of what he did at Bayern Munich wasn't really his coaching, but whether he had the stature to manage a club like Bayern Munich. And, you know, Chelsea are looking to be a similar type size club, aren't they?
Keith, AC Milan have a 1-0 aggregate lead over Napoli tonight. Arguably, would that be the more intriguing game to watch?
Yeah, it could be. AC Milan beat Napoli 4-0 just a couple of weeks ago at Napoli. So AC Milan would be absolutely full of confidence going there, having a 1-0 advantage as well. But look, Napoli have players that can hurt you on the counter-attack. They've been so good in the league, scoring, you know, a bag full of goals. I think it's 66 goals in the 30 games they played so far. They're 14 points ahead in the league. They got a draw on the weekend. I think they chopped and changed as well. So they've rested a couple of players. You can tell Napoli are going to go for it, but equally so did AC Milan. They rested a couple of big players on the weekend as well. So both teams are all in for this one. And it should be a cracker with the likes of Raspadori and Osimhen as well, scoring so many goals. It should be an absolute cracker and an all-Italian tie.
Well, that Chelsea-Real Madrid game is on RTÉ television this evening from 7:30pm. Keith and Mark, thank you so much for joining us. Ruby, thank you as always.
Cheers,
for
Marie.
Company.
Looking See you to... in Punchestown next week, Marie. Yeah. I promise to say hello to you. Now you'll be hanging around with Jane.
Girl power. And I'll be back tomorrow reflecting on these Champions League games and also looking ahead to tomorrow night's ones as well, plus our usual camogie and ladies football. Do join us. But for us now, bye, and Beto De Silva's up next. 2FM.